Friday the 19th of November, Barbara Dean and Joe Collins interviewing Christopher and Anne Pidsley at Shillingford Abbott.
Right across.
Now
right.
That's live.
That's live. Now, is it it's actually recording?
We're on record now.
Yes, okay. Yep, it's recording. Do you want to start again? Right, where did we start? Yes, on arrival at Chudley. Yes. It was back in the middle of 1970 that... Gary, go on, just put your thing on. Back in the middle of 1970 that I received a letter quite out of the blue suggesting that I might like to consider the possibility of moving from my work in Raynham in Essex to the country town of Chudley in Devon. Chudley was of course known to me because both my wife and I were born in Exeter, and so we were, at least we knew where Chudley was. I think we had possibly once stopped there for fish and chips, but that was about our only actual involvement in the town at all. Chudley, of course, in those days was dominated by the A38 and not the perhaps the most attractive places to live because of the dominance of the road. Anyway, I decided that it would be a good idea at least to go and have a look at Chudley and see what the possibilities were. I recall at that stage both my wife's mother and my own mother had been widowed fairly recently, and we felt it would be very helpful for us to be within easy reach of Exeter rather than way out to the east, the other side of London. So I visited and met the church council and the church wardens, and I well recall the evening of my visit we gathered at Teddy Haddo's house at Newington Lodge, and where Teddy served some of his delicious home-brewed mulberry wine using the mulberries that grew on a magnificent mulberry tree on the lawn in front of the house. And in the course of conversation that evening, it did seem to me that, yes, there was a job to be done, and maybe with our local knowledge, we might be the people to take on responsibility for leadership of the church in Chudley. So I duly reported back to Anne, who hadn't accompanied me on the first visit because we had a young family, and we decided that we would both go and visit, which we did. We were met by the vicar who was still there, the previous vicar, who talked to us, and we asked questions, and he showed us around the vicarage, a house, incidentally, which we loved because it had the most wonderful view from the windows across to Haytor and over Dartmoor, and I've always loved Dartmoor. And this seemed to be a good omen. And anyway, that wasn't the only thing that determined our decision. But in the course of time, and thinking about it and praying about it, we felt we could write to the folk at Chudley and say, yes, we would be willing to take on responsibilities there in due course. We duly moved at the beginning of November in 1970 and began to get the feel of the place. I must say it was very different from the place that we'd come from. We were responsible for what would now be called perhaps a daughter church in Raynham, and with a very much a growing congregation, lots of fat children. We'd recently been on a visit to Chessington Zoo, and in order to take everybody we had to hire 4 double-decker buses. So it was quite a growing and large body of people for whom we had become responsible and with whom we were happy to work. So moving to Chudley, where the congregation was mainly over 60, and there were very, very few families. In fact, I think our family and one or two others were the only families, really, who were regularly involved in the life of the church. There was a small Sunday school, the children from which came occasionally, but in terms of family involvement, it was pretty minimal. So we moved, and quite soon after our arrival, I began to feel that it was going to be very important to become really involved not just in the life of the church but also in the life of the community, because there was a job to do, and to relate the worship and witness of the church in an effective way, one had to get to know and become involved in and committed to the wider community of which one was a part. Because Chudley was very much that kind of place, small enough for people to know one another, and intimate enough to feel that by taking part in community events and contributing to those, that could very much help in the growth and development of the life of the church, which in fact over the years certainly proved to be the case. As I mentioned a moment ago, at that time Chudleigh was dominated by the traffic, and really it had become a sort of rather run-down looking little place simply because there was really no incentive for people, particularly those who lived in the main street through, to look after their houses, because as soon as they painted them or cleaned the windows, the dust and dirt from the passing traffic very quickly negatived any efforts that they may have made. So that was difficult. The other difficulty, of course, was that the road sort of cut the town in two. And there were those who said, well, sorry, I didn't make it to church, vicar, on Sunday. I couldn't get across the road. And which in many ways was not just an excuse. There was a certain degree of reality about that. And I can remember, because the vicarage front gate fronted on the parade, which was part of that thoroughfare right through the town, that it was quite difficult to drive out of the gate on many occasions, particularly to drive in the Plymouth direction, which meant turning across the traffic coming up the hill. And because the traffic was just so constant, I was going to say almost night and day, certainly in the summer it felt like that. So the prospect of a new road to take the traffic away from the town was something which was enormously welcome. And the road was started, I think, probably in early 72. And I well remember looking out of the bedroom window at the vicarage on one morning and actually seeing bulldozers in the field across the valley starting work, taking down, sadly, hedges, but that had to happen in order to begin to trace the route of the new road through to the west of Chudleigh. About 18 months before the road was due to open, in June 73, some of us were at a parish council meeting, and I think it was the annual meeting of the parish council, and I can remember getting up and suggesting that we ought to do something very significant in the town to celebrate the opening of the bypass. And this idea was quite readily picked up, and we formed the inevitable committee to begin work on planning the various events which would mark this milestone in the life of the town. Of the events that we planned, a number certainly stick out in my memory. For example, the first Sunday or Saturday, I forget what it was, of the week, we had arranged for the Royal Marine Band from Lymston to come, they assembled to the north of the town, just by where the road goes down the cricket field. And then the crowds were gathering in the centre of the town. In fact, that seldom have crowds ever been quite seen like it. I don't remember any carnival day when there were more people in the centre of the town. Of course, on this occasion, it was virtually the whole population of the town, not people from outside, and that was important. The band came down in splendid array, down through New Exeter Street, into the centre of the town, where they proceeded by counter-marching and other military procedures to celebrate what's called the beating of the retreat. And it really was a very moving ceremony as we together marked the beating of the retreat of the traffic from the centre of the town. And there was one humorous little incident. I was talking to bandsmen afterwards, and this man happened to play a trombone, and he said such was the enthusiasm and proximity of the crowds that on one occasion he was unable to play his instrument for fear of poking people in the ribs with the slide of his trombone.
What was the weather like? Do you remember the weather?
Yes,
on that day?
I think the weather, it was threatening rain, but it didn't rain. It wasn't a brilliant day. And indeed, the weather through the week, as I well recall, being responsible for a number of events, was a bit dodgy. We planned a parachute drop, and it wasn't till the very last minute that they were given the okay to do the drop because the cloud base was a bit low. And
but it happened successfully.
It did, yes. And I can remember the Carnival Queen, who was Susan Linton on that occasion, a daughter of Hazel and Les Linton. She was our first new Carnival Queen in the new series of carnivals. And she presented the paratrooper with a large bottle of whiskey. And he was threatened on pain of death not to land in the middle of the cricket square, but just to the side of it, which he managed to achieve, I have to say, to the acclaim of the people who gathered on the sports field. Another event during that week, which went extremely well, involved the primary school. And they had over a considerable period of time, prepared a historic pageant, and by means of a whole series of presentations marking each stage in the developing history of the town, each class took on a particular period or a particular event. It might be the coming of the Normans and the compiling of the Doomsday Record, or it might be medieval fairs which were started in Chudleigh in 1209, or it might be something to do with the traversing of William of Orange through the town on his way from Brixham to London, having arrived to take up the English throne, or it may be the event of the Fire of London, the Fire of Chudleigh, in May 1807, which caused such terrible devastation, and the following rebuilding programme of the town, which was arranged and organised by the then Lord Clifford. And in this and other ways, the whole history of the developing history of the town was portrayed by, very effectively, by the school children, and it was my responsibility to help to compile a commentary while they acted out the scenes. And I can remember being perched on top of one of the classrooms with a microphone and speaker system, giving the commentary as the historic events unfolded on the field below me.
Was a record kept of that occasion and that actual production?
I think I've still got a copy of the script somewhere. Yes, yes. And I, from my vantage point on top of the school, I actually managed to take a series of photographs while also doing the commentary, which have proved very useful over the years. So that was a very important week. And the final event, I particularly recall, we had a Thanksgiving service, a Songs of Praise in the parish church, and never before, I think, or not for many, many years, had the church ever been so completely full of people. We even had to bring the benches from the churchyard into the church in order to accommodate the people, and there were still people standing. So that was a wonderful event, and Dr. John Walters, at the conclusion of the service, proposed a very moving vote of thanks to all the people who had been involved in creating such a wonderful week of celebration. So that was memorable.
After the celebrations were over, the life began again.
Yes.
Did you notice a change immediately in the way people went about their business?
We noticed lots of changes.
Social changes?
Yes. I mean, there were the practical changes of the fact that you could cross the road in safety. And the noise, I think we got so used to the noise of the traffic going through. There was one person reputedly living in New Exeter Street who said that after the bypass was opened, they were kept awake at night by a cow mooing down by Kate Brook. Mm. And such country sounds, of course, couldn't be heard. And it did encourage, although there was a fear that Chudleigh would lose a lot of passing trade, I never believed that that would be the case, because not that many people actually stopped, apart from fish and chips occasionally. But because when you were travelling on the road to Plymouth, you really had great difficulty passing the lorries and things, and having passed them, you really didn't want to stop and let them all go past you again. And the fact that Chudleigh was comparatively free of traffic in those post-bypass days meant that people could come in from the surrounding countryside with greater ease and perhaps shop in Chudleigh in a way which they hadn't shopped before. Now, of course, that there are a number of shops have closed over the years, and that's a process which is common to almost every community, even in big cities as well, because of out-of-town shopping and supermarkets and what have you. I think, too, people began, after the opening of the bypass, to take a greater interest in their town, and more people, I think, began to get involved and feel that they had belonged to a community of which they could be a part, within which they could play a part, and of which they could be proud. So I think there was a greater social cohesion in the town. And, of course, about seven years after the opening of the bypass, in 1980... considerable development began to come with the start of the Palace Meadow development, and since that time, that has steadily proceeded to a greater or lesser extent. Right. So those are the changes, I think, that we've seen in the town. And it's been good too. The whole question of development and the pace of development has been important. We didn't get totally inundated with people. The development was fairly gradual, and it was possible to in various ways, I think, to help people become part of the place. I tried in a number of sort of ways, not least through the compiling of a slide presentation on the history of the town, to which we would, do once a year, and to which we would invite as many new people who'd moved in during the previous 12 months to help them, I think, get a feel of the place to which they had come, the events that had made it the place that it was, and what the opportunities were for getting involved today. And hopefully that played some small part in the integration of the new people with the old people.
The newcomers, yes. Chudley, people who were born in Chudley, yes. regarded newcomers, anyone who came into the town as newcomers, and that still happens today. It's a gradual process. It will never change in that way as long as there is building going on.
As long as
people are going to be regarded as newcomers.
Of course, and the people who were 10, 15 years ago were newcomers regard themselves as old established residents and then have thoughts about the people who are following them. And I think it was particularly true when there were still quite a lot of people who were born and bred in Chudley, whose families had lived in Chudley for generations. You could count them as old Chudley. Occasionally I would take a funeral and someone would say to me, there was a lot of old Chudley here today, you know. But that's probably not so much the case. I can remember, we were talking about characters, and dear Vera Knight telling me on one occasion, she was born in a house in number 55 Clifford Street and lived there till she was into her 80s, in the same house. And she said to me one day, "'Tis all Warreners, you're a vicar," she said. "'There's only me and Maud up top and Della and Beat down bottom, but still the same.'" Do you want me to talk a bit about characters?
Please.
Yes.
It would be so interesting to hear about the tramps who lived,
right,
and in fact who had contact with
because Chudley was on a main road. We used to get quite a lot of tramps going through the town, but we also had one or two ladies or gentlemen of the road, whatever term you like to use, actually taking up residence in the old lime kiln, which lies near Harkham Garage between the two carriageways, a perilous place to get to. And before I arrived in Chudley, there'd been a lady tramp, Ethel Riley, who'd lived there for some considerable time. And then when she vacated this delectable residence, a gentleman who had various names. He was generally called sometimes the Earl of Harkham, but he referred to himself as Frank Whitten, or as Frank Robbins, or Vic Whitten. People called him a whole variety of names, some ordinary proper names, some names that one wouldn't want to use for various reasons. But he was quite a fearsome character. He was fairly tall and had a shock of fairly unkempt hair and a beard. And he used to have a variety of rather weird headgear, not least that he used to wear. And you're making signals to me. We can edit this out.
His paws.
Yeah.
What I was going to say is, he looked at you with one eye and not the other.
Yes, I see. Yes, right. Yes.
I don't think that was
paws. Right.
Now you are. Talk.
Now wait a minute. We're back on the
no.
did
Can I tell you something? Yeah. I've just pressed.
Yes, I should be recording now. Yes, that's right. I think we got to the point then of the bottle of whiskey, so I better go back to the bottle of whiskey and carry on from there. Which really takes us on into Carnival Week, the celebration week, and the pageant I think I've mentioned, I hope so, yes. The weather you were asking me about, I'm just trying to think, yes, that's
on
right.
On the day.
On the day, and yes. The cloud base being nearly too low for the parachute jump. But anyway, that happened, and the paratrooper landed duly in the appointed spot marked out on the cricket field, and he was presented with his bottle of whisky by Susan Linton. The final event of the week Well, of course, I should have mentioned the actual carnival, and I didn't. On the Saturday, which was the renewing of the Chudley Carnival, which had become totally impossible to hold on any day of the week, let alone a Saturday, because of the traffic. And so that was reinstated, and very successfully. And we had an excellent carnival, lots of floats and lots of walking participants. And then on the final day, the Sunday, we had a great service of thanksgiving in the parish church on the Sunday evening, which took the form of a songs of praise, and crowds of people came. The whole week had really built up as the week went along, and everybody seemed to feel that there's something they had to be involved. It was such an important time for the town. And there were so many people turned up for this event in the parish church that we had to bring the benches from the churchyard into the church itself for people to sit on. And even then there were people standing. And at the conclusion, I recall Dr. John Walters giving a very moving vote of thanks to all those people who had made this week of celebration and joy possible. So that was a great time, and Chudley began to change with the reduction of the traffic. It was easier, an easier place to even to talk to people in the street. People began to paint their houses, clean their windows, and the whole place took on a new air of life and vitality. And people began to be able to take a pride in their town, and I think probably too people felt more involved in the various organisations and activities, which proceeded to do well as a result of almost the rebirth, if you like, of the town. This was certainly true in the continuing life of the church, and over the years, of course, Chudley has expanded, and one of the things we did to try and integrate people into the life of the town, I produced a slide series which I used to give an account of the history of the town. Some of the slides I used were those from the school pageant, but many others as well of topographical items of interest and the Iron Age camp and the caves and the lime kilns and the fish ponds and all the other physical features, buildings, roads, evidence of the fire and so on, taking people through the way the town has evolved from the days of the first cave dwellers who lived clearly under Chudley Rocks to the time of, up to the present day. And this, I do think, did give people a sense of place and a sense of understanding of that, the area to which they'd come and the events which had led to making the town what it was. Another thing I can remember doing was encouraging the Amenity Society to produce a new town sign. In fact, I drew up some designs for it, which were not totally accepted, but nearly, with that 1309 ancient wall town, again, just to trigger people's interest. As you drive into the town, it raises, oh, what's a wall town? It's been here a long time, just a date and a statement. And in other little ways, I think, hopefully, we've endeavoured to establish a clear identity for the town, particularly for the benefit of those people moving in.
Was there outside interest in what was happening to Chudley? Because other towns too would be benefit from the bypass.
Yes, like that's right. Buckfastleigh and Ashburton actually had sort of partial bypasses in the past. They were greatly extended and expanded, but Chudley was, you didn't have to drive through Buckfastleigh or Ashburton to get to Plymouth. You could go round them, and so their bypasses were actually old bypasses, were incorporated into the new A38. It was Chudley particularly that had no bypass where the problem lay, and of course Ivy Bridge too, which had no bypass until the new road was built. Yes, other towns were interested, certainly, and I remember I was invited to preach at Kingstainton when the new road went round the back of Kingstainton, at the opening of there, the Kingstainton bypass. And when we had the service at the beginning of our bypass, I invited the Vicar of Cullumpton to come, because they'd just been bypassed before we had. So there was quite a lot of that sort of interchange between communities and comparing of notes between communities who'd been bypassed by the new road. So that was very important.
So you noticed the difference after the bypass. Life became different, and it was very noticeable.
It was much more tolerable. I mean, walking up to the town, particularly where the pavements are narrow, and if you had a pushchair, I remember our little daughter Claire, she used to cower in her pushchair when these big lorries went past when her mother was, or I was pushing her up to the shops. And this was even worse in people who lived in New Exeter Street, where the pavements are extremely narrow, particularly on the eastern side of the road. So yes, it and you could talk to people happily without sort of the rush of air of big lorries going past you as you stood perhaps outside the post office or wherever. Mm. So it did make a very real difference. And of course, with the rebirth of the carnival, from that point on, not only the carnival procession itself, but a proper carnival week was carried on beyond the celebration week. And that gave an annual opportunity for different groups and organisations to contribute to an integrated community event. So they weren't just doing their own thing through the year. There were occasions when the whole community came together. And that certainly, in my thinking, was extremely important to help to foster good community relationships. And as a church, we got involved with floats and various other bits and pieces. And I myself, I have to confess, most years dressed up in some outlandish costume and went round with my tin, which I used to do rather well with my tin, I must say, because people must give something to the poor vicar, they said. So that was all good fun. And
there are photographs and records of this event.
Oh, yes.
Which we'll be able to share.
Yes, yes, many photographs and records.
Most interesting.
Yes, yes. Did we get on to characters, or have we got to repeat the character thing? I'm not sure where we did. Perhaps we ought to go back to dare we go back to Frank Robbins, because I don't think we've actually got most of that on tape somehow.
Yeah.
You were asking me about characters. There are many that I can remember. Hopefully you've got the bit about Vera Knight. I think you have. If not, I'll give it to you sometime. Frank Robbins lived in the lime kiln between the two carriageways just near Harkham Garage. It was pretty primitive up there, literally just a sort of... The lime kiln has two entrances, one of which he used to keep his bike in and the other which he used to live in. And he had an old plastic bit of polythene sheeting hung across to try and keep the weather out. And he had a fire inside, of course, because being a lime kiln, there was a flue going up through the back. So if he had a fire in the cave, as it were, entrance, the smoke would go through and out at the back and come out at the top. And occasionally people driving down the road would see this smoke coming out and wonder what on earth was happening in the verges between the two. He used to come into town on his bicycle, either pushing it or riding it, depending on whether it was in working order or not. And he often used to bring it to the vicarage to have it repaired. I remember our oldest son was pretty good with bicycles, and he would frequently on a Sunday morning after church have to go and mend the bicycle, put in a new cotter pin or mend the chain or whatever it was he needed done. But I tried to... One of the reasons that I'm particularly interested in him, because he didn't really seem to know who he was. He had a sort of identity crisis. And I did some considerable research, not only interviewing him and trying to get a rather tangled story out of him, which started in a most romantic way about when he was a toddler and remember living in a big house and crawling out down into the garden and falling through a hedge and being picked up by gypsies and taken to a gypsy encampment. Now, whether there's a grain of truth in that, I have no idea. I did manage to identify the fact that he had lived in Salford, in Manchester, between the wars, that he had a mother called Gertie, and a father called John, and his mother was killed in a tram crash in 1930 in the city. And thereafter, he went to work on a farm. And then, having worked on the farm, he joined the Merchant Navy. During the war, it seemed he was certainly torpedoed once, if not twice, which would probably account for his agitated and unsettled state of mind. He never really recovered, I think, from the trauma of being torpedoed. And you see, once I learned that, I thought, goodness me, you know, here is a man who's actually risked his life to bring food to our nation during the wars. And he needs looking after, he needs caring for, he needs understanding, he needs friendship. And he told me that his foster father worked for the police in Manchester, so I wrote to the police and got them to look up their records, which they confirmed that a gentleman of this name did live there, that he used to sing in the choir at St John the Baptist Church in Salford. Again, I identified the church, so that part of the story all began to tie up. And I remember one occasion he came to me, he said, "I'm going to Manchester." He brought his case for me to look after in the vicarage before he went off to catch the train. He said, "You'd better have a look and see what was inside." And the most amazing collection of old bits and pieces, an old blow lamp, which he insisted was an antique. So I had to take special care of this old blow lamp. And off he went. In fact, I've literally got postcards that he sent to me in my possession. And then before he was due back, I had a phone call from the curate of Holy Trinity Church Platt in Manchester saying they got a gentleman who called himself Victor who hadn't got any money for a train fare. Was it all right to give him some money for a train fare? I said, "Oh yes, that's all right. When he gets back, if it gets me how much, I'll reimburse you." And so he came back on the train, and again he paid back. He was most scrupulous. If I ever lent him money, which I did on many occasions, he would always be most concerned to pay it back. I remember even taking him to Bovey Hospital, for he'd injured himself and needed to go to the little have some stitches in his finger. Insisted on paying me for my petrol and taking him to Bovey Hospital. And I did many, many train car journeys with him, taking him to Social Security and trying to sort out his pension and what have you.
What happened to him?
Yes, he became ill, and he was not well enough towards the end to continue living where he had lived in the lime kiln. It was just too cold in the winter. We used to take him wood, and Christmas Day, I remember he came and had Christmas dinner in our conservatory. And he went to a home in Newton Abbot to begin with, where he never settled. Because of his psychological problems, he found it very difficult to live in a constricted place with people. He was much happier in the lime kiln, really. But then finally he had to go into hospital, and when he was discharged he went to a house in Exeter, in just off Blackboy Road, where there was a lady who looked after discharged people who had no home, and there were, I think, three or four of them there. And then eventually he died there, and we brought him back to Chudley for his funeral, and that was quite an occasion. So I remember.
Was it attended by many people in Chudley?
The funeral, you mean? Yes. Oh, yes. Quite a lot of people came, and he was a character, and communities are enriched by their characters. We mustn't patronise characters, but there are many others that I can think of. George Wakeham was someone whom you were mentioning. George. There's a trophy presented at the carnival, the George Wakeham Shield, presented every year for the most colourful contributor to the carnival procession. And George arrived on the Chudley scene, I would have said, in about 1980 or thereabouts, some 10 years after Frank. And his story was that he'd been born in a Salvation Army hostel in Plymouth. His mother, I don't know, when he was still very young, was taken into the psychiatric unit at Star Cross, where he remained with his mother. And then when she died, it was thought he couldn't cope in the community, so he remained in Star Cross Hospital. Finally, particularly with the advent of care in the community and other changes in mental health law, he was allowed to live out. He lived for a short while in Chudley Knighton, and then he was provided with a maisonette down in Halden View. And he was, again, quite a colourful character. He liked his bit of drink, but people humoured him. And again, he used to dress up every year quite outlandishly and take part in the carnival procession. But again, George also used to come to church, and he loved coming to church. He was confirmed. And I can remember him well being part of one of the confirmation classes. And he used to ask the most penetrating questions. On one occasion he said, "Here, Vicar," he said, "how would it have been if the Virgin Mary had had twins?" And I said, "Well, George, I've never been asked that question before." And he said, "Tell you what, Vicar, when I die," he says, "and if I go to heaven, will I be able to recognise you when I get there?" And I said, "Well, George, I very much hope so. And will I be able to say to you, 'Bless you, sir, it was all true what you told me'?" He was a real character. I have one particular vision of him on an occasion when Clifford Street was being dug up and resurfaced, being renewed and relayed, and the traffic was diverted from Clifford Street, and there were JCB and other machinery working in Clifford Street, and George, who had injured his foot because he stepped off a Dodgem car when the fair was at Chudley, before the ride had concluded, and he got hit by somebody else driving another Dodgem. And so he had a stick, and so walking up to the town was quite difficult. And so he couldn't come up Clifford Street, at least that he thought he couldn't. Anyway, he hitched a lift from a JCB, and I came, walked down Clifford Street on the side with the road, the carriageway actually up, and there was this JCB coming up the road with George sitting in the bucket at the front. Always remembered that. He was quite a character. When he came to church, he'd come in just as the first hymn was about to begin, and the choir would be proceeding in one direction down the south aisle, and George would be coming in the opposite direction. These people enrich our lives, I think, and it's good to look back and smile.
There aren't those characters as commonly these days. In fact, one wonders if they'd be tolerated in the way they used to be, the way people are regarded these days.
I would hope so, but they just, as you say, I can't, list in my final years in Chudley, I can't really think of anybody who could be regarded as a character in the sense of some of these people, and there are many others I could talk about. Dear Vic Martin and Ken Hervin, all of whom have very interesting stories, really. That'll be for another time, I suspect.
With the oral history being taken for the millennium, there'll be many stories. Different people have different stories to tell. It's all going to be most interesting when it all comes together. Thank you very much for talking to us today.
Okay, right. Well, I mean, there's many...
Very interesting indeed. Hmm.